Hi, I'm John.
Hi, I'm Olivia.
Hi, I'm Dan.
Hi, I'm his brother Kevin.
And this week we've watched The Naked Now, and now we're going to argue about whether it's going to make us quit Star Trek.
I would like reparations for having to witness Data speak about his multiple techniques that he's advanced in.
There was once a young lady from Venus
No.
whose body was shaped like a
That's
penis.
enough.
I can't
You're
fucking
done.
do it. I can't fucking
You're
do
done.
it.
I don't understand. Like, we're supposed to have watched the show, not memorize every line from it, guys.
Well,
Do
some
you
of
know
them don't
who?
leave your mind, and that's the
Some of
issue.
them. Data making a dick joke in the second episode of The Next Generation to go on television. I wasn't going to
Yeah.
forget that.
How can you introduce the characters and then immediately ruin them in my mind?
Yeah.
Ugh.
I'd
You
like
know
to
what
know how many
also.
people watched this episode when it was live. Like, because I feel like most Trek fans are going back and watching these episodes. But to watch this one without really knowing who Picard is or who these people are, I think it's. I also want to make a little referendum that I am dealing with a sickness, so my voice has been cut
You
through the
sound like
blender.
you have a
Yeah,
frog in your
I
throat.
yes. So I apologize to all those listeners out there.
And can
Merry
I just
Christmas,
say,
everyone.
and here's what I'm picturing. Like one of our lead writers, Aaron Waelke, he was first introduced to Star Trek by Next Generation. And he remembers being a little kid on that staircase. He was supposed to be in bed or something, and he stayed up late, and his father was watching the pilot of Next Generation, and how the disc, the saucer comes off of the ship of the Enterprise, and it blows this little kid's mind. And he must have seen the second episode.
Oh yeah, I'm sure
And
dad like that. Get back up
now
there,
he's
nerds.
watching
Get
Naked.
back up there right now.
Now he's watching Naked Now. And yeah, he's probably sent back up the stairs. Like what kid, like
And come on
this little
down.
kid
Hopefully
was
the
getting
next one.
excited.
Hopefully the next one won't be so bad. Oh, it's Code of
It's
Honor.
like,
This one.
oh,
This
it's
one.
like when you have a friend, they're introducing you to a new friend. It's like, oh, he's great, he's this and that and that. And then he brings his girlfriend. And instead of like getting to know this person, you just have to watch him and his girlfriend eat each other's faces for 4 hours in a pub. That was this
Yes.
episode. It's like, I'm not gonna get to know you, and I never have, because all I've seen is what is what you do with your tongue when you think no one else is watching. That was this
It's
episode of
like
television.
truly, truly uncomfortable.
But
They
at least the
established
Naked
that
Time gave us
Wesley,
Spock crying.
they established very early on that Wesley Crusher is a terrorist. I feel like what he does with this, I mean, when he talks to Geordi's like, what's this? He's like, oh, I pretend to be the captain. And Geordi's like, that's pretty cool. Like, not
Yeah.
like, no, kid, like, which one go on the
Let
right
me take
path?
that toy from you. That's a little dangerous.
I mean, to be credit to Geordi, he was completely fucking hammered. But
I've
yeah.
been a Wesley defender for so long, and I think I'm realizing now it's because I've skipped most of season one of TNG. This made me hate Wesley almost immediately, and it's the third episode in, so now I'm suddenly understanding the
Yeah, I had to go
struggles.
back and
This
make
is.
sure that he was actually touched, because because it's like I thought he was just hot in the sweaters. I
Yeah,
wasn't
I
sure.
love the sweaters. It's just.
We picked this episode because it's like when we started doing Prodigy, we were like, oh my God, we can't screw this up. We had such pressure on our shoulders. The first few episodes, so vital. Your first season to not only set up the characters and the world correctly, but you got to hook your audience, right? And I'm just like putting myself, in Gene Roddenberry and the entire team behind Next Gen, and all this time has passed, and they're bringing Trek back, and how are they going to do it? And every episode must be precious, and no, they blow it on episode two.
Yeah, like
They.
Encounter at Farpoint was like a really great start, and that, introducing Q, a character's
Yes, cool.
longevity
Yeah, that was great.
probably going on forever. But to go, okay, what other bullets do we have in the barrel? Well, we got this
Countless ideas.
explorer.
Like the writer's room must have had countless concepts and ideas to like bring back Star Trek, new ideas. But no, they do an old idea that just has everyone, yes, drunk, So you don't have any concept of who these people are. Like I have yet to fall in love with the crew of Next Gen, and this episode didn't help me. Yes, it happened much later.
But Kevin, I also picked this episode because we did the exact same thing. You look at...
Oh, God, no, you did.
Dreamcatcher.
Oh, my God.
We waited until episode four, technically three. Well, they don't get drunk and naked, but they go to a planet and their dreams and fantasies come true, so to speak.
Yeah, but it highlights each of their characters, so I understand the characters better.
But is that that's it, their innate desires? Is it rather than some delusion?
Well, that was the point of this episode. It was meant to show the whole, what do they really want to be? But it just made them all horny?
Yeah.
Well, that's Trek tradition. And that's Gene's true vision. So how far can we hate it, you know?
So just in case any listeners live under a rock and haven't figured this out, you guys are the showrunners of Starship Prodigy, which one member of this podcast team thinks is the best piece of Trek media ever created, and the other one, you know, thinks Murph is the best person to ever exist. So well done, guys. But how did you guys get into Star Trek in the first place? Was it a kid thing? Was it an adult thing? Was it a somebody strapped you to a chair and made you watch it thing?
I mean, we were kind of in between the movies and Next Gen. I'll let Kevin tell the story since his voice is a lot more soothing than mine.
Oh, about how we started the show? I mean,
how we got into Star Trek.
Oh, just how I fell in love with Star Trek was the movies. You know, I was at that, you know, I personally, like, if I had to pick one Trek series I'm the biggest fan of, it would be, I'm an original series guy.
Oh, yeah.
And it really was the movies, because I was at that prime age, you know, and the movies were just coming out. It's like, especially Wrath of Khan was my first, you know, entrance into Star Trek. And it was both cerebral, but emotional, and it was just amazing and cinematic and big. And so I was a little bit too old for TOS, you know, TOS was probably having reruns and at that time. And then Next Gen, I was like in college at that time, and I didn't have a TV, so I really wasn't watching TV. So that's how I fell in love. And same with Dan. Dan's just 2.5 years younger than me. And
That steady eel in the ear, like, just messed me up. But I thought that, like, it felt like the adult space adventure compared to Star Wars. I always had, there was always someone in my life who was big into Star Trek, whether it was my roommate or a friend, you know, like, and so it was always on in the background.
I have to also say, like, of course, like, Star Wars was impressionable as a kid, but also, like, I think one of the biggest movies that, you know, of space that moved us was Flash Gordon.
Yeah.
Which my heart goes out. Mike Hodges, the director.
Oh, he just passed, didn't he?
He just passed. But my God, and you could probably, if you look at Prodigy, I think our director, Ben Ebon, is definitely, he's a huge Flash Gordon fan too. And you just, the design, there's some beautiful, sleek designs that kind of harken to that 80s film.
Olivia, this is important. You've never seen Flash Gordon, have you?
I have not seen Flash
Gordon. You know, that's Brian Blessed. That's Pete Brian Blessed.
Oh.
That's Gordon's alive.
Flash Gordon's alive. Yeah,
send me the clip. Maybe it's Patreon content.
We did this project a year or two ago called the movie version of Troll Hunters called Rise of the Titans.
Yeah.
And we needed a voice for the dragon. And Guillermo's like, "Who should we get?" I go, "We got to get Brian Blessed." And he's like, "All right, let's get Brian Blessed." So we did our part. I love Brian Blessed was the original Tarzan yodel. I'm not going to do it right now because I might die.
Oh, my God.
That was Brian Blessed.
I saw there was, for the anniversary of the film, they did it at the British Museum on a big screen. Like,
Flash?
Flash Gordon, and he introduced it. I've never seen a man both not want to be there and be so excited about being there my entire life. He sort of walks on stage like, "What the fuck am I doing?" And so the moment he opens his mouth, it's like, "Oh, my God. You've been thinking about this for like a month and a half, haven't you, Brian?"
That sounds like us with this podcast.
That's a fair point. But yeah, Flash Gordon, that's, oh, God.
Yeah.
So, I mean, movie, that's a good entry. Was there a quitting point for you guys then? You know, as you got older?
Was there when we wanted to quit Star Trek?
When you watched an episode and sort of it ended and the commercial started, you're like, why did I spend an hour doing that?
Are you legally allowed to quit?
Are you going to get a call from lawyers if you say you quit Star Trek? Because
no, there's
we have
never,
good legal. We have good people.
Never. I don't know. I can't say there's ever a time.
Star Trek 5, the movie. I remember like Star Trek 4 was awesome, but then Star Trek 5, I was like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Don't mess with those movies.
Yeah.
But no, it wasn't. I don't think we were ever really on the bus enough to get off the bus.
Yeah, it always comes and goes. Like, even like, you know, when I was younger, I couldn't say the original motion picture grabbed me, but I recently watched it again. And I'm like, I loved it as an adult, like going in knowing it's going to be these prolonged shots and this, you know, ship pornography, you know, sequences and stuff. I love it now. It's beautiful. But I have to say, like, it doesn't make me quit, but it always makes me go, ugh, is just the procedural. We're so about serialized stories, and like to have every episode to have the most craziest thing happen. You know, we're just talking about the Tuvix episode, and how that it's insane what happens in that episode. And then by the end of it, it's okay, we're back in our seats, let's just go on to the next adventure, and it's all forgotten. Whatever that history was between these characters is kind of gone.
Yeah, and we were yearning for that. We were always yearning for that emotion. And like also another Voyager, like Ensign Kim dies. And like there's hardly a broken heart in the ship. It's like, oh my gosh, she's died.
Swap Ensign Kim for another Ensign Kim.
It was a space anomaly.
Yeah.
What?
They swap Ensign Kim for another Ensign Kim, except this Ensign Kim comes with a baby.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm yearning for like them to break out of there. I think that's why the concept of our show, we're always yearning for people to break out of their Starfleet Academy mold. I'm like, show us who you really are.
Yeah. It's funny. This is one of my long writing thoughts about Star Trek is that TOS has a certain feel to it because half of all the cast and writers had been through some form of military service. So they understood what personality that looks like. And I think the further we've away from gotten that, a lot of the writers forgot that people who are in uniform are still people and often just do shit because it's who they are. And one thing I like for Prodigy is coming to it externally through the kids and then actually through Jane, where you guys have gone, actually, no, these are people, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, your point's great. And Dan and I have absolutely zero military experience. So we have no concept of how that goes.
No, it's almost like the show was built off of our fear of writing a Star Trek show. Literally, the first thing we said was, I don't know how to write bridge speak. I don't know how to even, you know.
Just as a point, guys, it's probably a good thing you didn't have to fight the Nazis. Don't feel too bad that you didn't get conscripted and sent to Normandy. So, like, you guys are doing all right.
Yes. Yeah. Very.
We took orders from Captain Crunch. That was it.
I mean, it's an interesting.
I have to say though, like on that topic, it's so strange. You know, like Dan and I now have children, and we have like you know a young son and daughter, and you know to say like you know we've never had to be drafted. My father was drafted. My grandfather, you know, every generation was drafted and had to fight in a war, and my brother and I never had to, you know, and just there is that fear of what if there is a war someday and my son might be, and I have no experience. I have no concept of how.
Yeah, let's get back to the naked now.
Let's talk about this. This is a bit too heavy for this podcast. You know, I haven't finished my beer and I'm not staring at
you. Naked right now.
You're fighting war.
Yeah. We said that on the auxiliary episodes. It's fine.
But Dan was saying the fear of writing Star Trek, it was utterly frightening. Like at our first gut instinct when they asked us, we're like, no, I don't want to be slayed by the swords of every Star Trek fan out there and every arrow, you know, it's too scary. But then we realized, you know, not just to protect us in a sense that these characters were outside of the Star Trek universe going in, but just that suddenly made these characters in the show super accessible for a new viewer or a young kid who knows nothing to really start with ground zero. You know, step one, let's dipping your toe into the Star Trek universe. What do we share? What happens? You know?
And I think, yeah, it's that sort of first step is always incredibly hard writing. And honestly, you know, you guys did, this is going to be mean to God, you know, DC Fontana, and you guys did it better than they did it. I'm just like, this is like,
well, thank you.
Are you saying more, you know, Star Trek writers should be motivated by fear? Is that, yes, the key?
They should be scared of us.
Yeah, I mean, I think people who go in very cavalierly are the ones who get skewered, because it's like, you know, because we're, Kevin, well, and I are hard on ourselves because we're brothers.
And I have, like, but, and I have to say, like, you know, Alex Kurtzman and everyone over at Secret Hideout, CBS, everyone really trusted us. Like, everyone really liked our concept when we went in and our pitch. And they, in every step of the way, I think they were impressed by what we were writing and our animatics and what it was looking like. So we had very little pushback. And I have to imagine back then, you know, with Gene and with, like, let's say Next Generation and starting a brand new show and getting a new captain, oh, that's, yeah, totally different from, like, that's, and it's live action. You've got a lot more voices, you know, that can be very daunting, you know, and scary.
I mean, there could have been an exec where, like, in the writer's room, they go, we know this guy likes sex romps. Let's give him Naked Now. Let's, yeah, you know, let's whip it out.
Can we get the word naked in the second episode, please? Title.
And I love that they had the canon. It's like they had the canon of all these great TOS episodes. And, you know, they had to pull the, what's the Naked
Time?
The Naked Time.
Naked Time from TOS, yeah. And Dan, that was episode 4 of season 1. So that was pretty
good. The writers room was like, hadn't even seen the first season. They were just watching him chronologically and be like,
I mean, the thing about the Naked Time is that in the Naked Time, it's not like, oh, they want to have a sex justice. They're all a bit pissed. So, like, yeah, Sulu, yeah, just thinks he's, yeah, D'Artagnan, and Spock starts crying. And so it's like, they're not all just horny. Like, there's a, yeah, lot of nuance.
Yes, exactly.
And the, yeah, the drama Naked works. Time
was much, yeah, it was much more about, like, space madness, you know.
And what year was it where Hollywood turned? Because there used to be boobs in every movie. And it felt like, there was the season of Porky's and things like that. Then all of a sudden, like weird science, and then all of a sudden it stopped. It was
1987. So this is sort of actually the end of Hollywood discover, yeah, of the sort of Reagan era of, we've removed all regulation from media. Have fun, kids.
So the end of the sex revolution, the beginning of just.
I mean, Olivia, this is post sex revolution. This is, we're going to make money off of the after effects of the sex revolution.
Yeah, this is the misogyny, like, starts.
This is the misogyny, the age of the golden age of, this is the age of the misogyny, is the age of the blaxploitation film, you know, invading Grenada, these vibes-based politics, you know.
Yeah.
But,
yeah,
like, it's just, even the start is odd, because it just is like, oh, we're listening to someone flirt with Data.
No, the opening looks like they're all looking, like a bunch of dudes looking at porn, and like, it's a really awkward shot where, yeah, someone's like, oh, I hope there's a bunch of pretty boys on that ship. And I'm like, ugh.
I just realized, who was speaking there? That was
the captain, presumably.
Oh God.
But they have these like leering shots of Riker, Picard, and Data. I don't know.
That was really unforgivable. I don't want to see Picard in any sexual situations. I don't want to think of him in that way. Well, he is an asexual philosopher.
Can we talk about that right now? Like the Beverly Crusher Picard scenes?
Oh my God. That laugh that he gives.
But that was before he was affected. That's what troubles me most.
Yeah. Well, no, he was starting to. Well, I don't know. Yeah, was he of clear mind at that moment, or was he
was never touched. He's
guilty of that.
It's like this weird.
Is it a lot? I thought he was clearing his throat.
Don't defend him, John.
No.
I wasn't defending him. I was pushing
his arousal. He was trying to subdue his arousal.
I love that he's so from the prophet. There's a dynamo under there. There's a dynamo that he's like. They're like a steel clamps around this sexual dynamo of Picard.
Oh. And then when you film a scene, you know, you're doing that scene a few times. And then there's probably, he probably did a different laugh.
Let's go back a few different takes.
But they went with that one. That was the best.
I mean, the worst is that from what we know of like how early TNG was directed, it wasn't like the actors like, I'm going to try this or that. It was a director going, no, you are going to do the scene exactly like this, and you will not deviate from how I want to do it.
What do you think the direction? What do you think the direction was to make that sound?
I don't want to know.
Terrify us all. Was it that they were trying to emulate some TOS energy, which is just slightly, I don't know, camp?
Oofy. It was the wrong sort of, if it was camp, yeah. It was the wrong sort of camp for the. It was very 80s.
I think
also, like we can show
people, each other.
We can show people being horny on TV now because it's the late 80s. It was like, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
But I want to say that I think this may be an unpopular opinion, but I don't think Picard was affected. He was never touched. There's a little sound effect, and if you watch that scene, he gets very close to Crusher.
Yeah, he does that lean in, which is
no
the worst thing I've ever seen.
There's no, but then he starts sweating shortly afterwards. So
I mean, memory alpha seems to suggest that he did get infected.
Yeah, yeah, he was dealing with it, or the starts of it, I think.
Well, I go out there, kids, and watch that scene again, and he doesn't touch Crusher.
In a day of time of COVID now, it's just like every scene, like even the scene with Geordi and Wesley, everyone's faces are like 3 inches apart, and they're just having a conversation. It's so weird.
Yeah.
I even at the very beginning of the episode when they mentioned the ship, I had to pause and play it over and over again to try. It's the SS Sulkowski. What is it?
Sulkowski.
I thought it was Tchaikovsky.
It is the SS Sulkowski. Which was built
because you looked it up. You're
of course
looking
I looked
it up right now.
It is an Oberth class starship built at Baikonur Cosmodrome in the USSR. That's right, kids. The Soviets didn't lose the Cold War in Star Trek. It's still going. It's technically it's still called Leningrad in the 23rd century.
Oh,
like Chekhov. Okay. Chekhov literally calls it Leningrad sometimes.
Yes, that's
and I think I really think Strangey World should lead into this and just have it be called Leningrad and they'll explain why.
And also like our characters in Prodigy, they're young, they're naive, they don't know what
it
they're doing.
It feels dirty talking about Prodigy in this episode. It feels like
what? No, but
it's almost like you guys have been doing something related to Star Trek in the last couple of years. Who'd have known?
Our characters are constantly making mistakes, but when I watch this episode, my God, there is such poor decisions being made and such like just
no
the
repercussions.
The whole maximum decontamination, you know, oh, we did it. And what is it like? Geordi's like affected. Everyone around him just treats it like, oh, just lay down and we're going to walk around, like even though there could be a disease.
And then Riker goes and like touches Beverly Crusher and like everyone's touching each other at a time.
And then Beverly like supposed to keep guard on Geordi and she just lets him lay there and goes off into another room so he can just get up and walk around. Like what? There's no security.
How many staff are on these ships? John, why is it she needs some help?
There are 1,000 people. There's no one on there. USS Enterprise D. There are 4 sick bays.
Mm. And
was
no
everybody
nurses?
Just at lunch?
No, yeah, everyone seems to be of pristine health. No one is in there with a cough or a.
Well,
don't
remember, TNG, they've eliminated the common cold and the headache.
Yes.
Like, they don't like headaches in 24th century, which, you know, that's nice.
I'm just happy I'm not taking my clothes
the
off.
The science, like the science of it, wasn't very sound. I felt, you know.
I mean, when a Star Trek is in the, we are at a point now. There's always this thing. It's like, you know, Star Trek writers like Gene work with nuclear engineers. They talked enough in TNG. You guys have Era McDonald, but no, it's 50% of the time. It's this will be fun. Yeah, fuck it, we'll do that.
Yeah.
And then retroactively try and make it seem like it
makes
could
sense. Like,
reality.
Like, what the fuck is a warp drive, guys? We're still not on this. Dude.
And then Shimoda. Is it Shimoda? How come he regressed to be a baby? Feels like he got a
this
different...
Feels like
everyone else got drunk, but he's like becomes a man child.
Was the first take him being sexy? They're like, no, Shimona, we're going to do something different.
You know what?
You get to be a baby.
So were we seeing their personalities when they were drunk? Is that what we were seeing? Essentially, if they had had a few liters of vodka, it would be the same thing. I'm just happy I didn't have to see Wesley being horny, because if it was TOS, they would have done it. It would have been like that Charlie X episode, which trauma.
It's just because we have the...
I have countless issues with this episode. There's even like, they make a big deal out of Jordy sitting up in his medical bed. He's been left alone for whatever reason, even though he's supposedly infected by a virus that could spread through the entire ship. And he takes off his badge and puts it down and then leaves. And there's nothing that they find him later on. Like someone who was it? Josh Yar. Just walks in and finds him without, you know, like
in the conference lounge, which is just off of the bridge.
Oh, are we saying we want more terrifying surveillance? Because they seem to have quite a lot of it, to be fair.
As a writer, though, you don't do that unless you're going to do something with that in the episode. Like, oh, they're searching for him and they can't find him because he doesn't have his badge. And oh my God, he could be anywhere. But
as a writer, you know what you also never do? Is that Data Tasha Yar conversation. I felt like, oh my God, they're like, oh, very sexy. And then talking about her horrible trauma of her past. And I'm like, what is
this? You don't just an insane transition that was.
You don't drop the mind rapes.
TNG seems to be obsessed with talking about Tasha's rape gangs in a way that only late 70s television could do.
Yeah.
Like they've got to this point where they're allowed to say that word on television, but they haven't figured out that they probably shouldn't.
Yes. So true. So true.
I just feel bad for Denise Crosby. I feel like she is just given horrible material for her character. You know, Code of Honor, the next one, the stuff that they gave her for
she
that.
She was great.
Even in the sort of scene with her and Deanna, where it was like comparing, like she wants to become someone else, like she's not good enough, even as her version of a woman, was kind of, you know, negative on her character. Seems a bit upsetting.
But I kind of like where they started her on Counterpoint or the encounter at Farpoint, where, okay, tough security officer. And then they just like regress her. I don't know.
Why is she lacking in confidence? Why does that have to be part of it? She can be her own woman.
And
what was it? So did I miss it? But, you know, this was, in essence, this was a virus, right? This was a... They label it a virus.
Try to touch someone's skin and hear a sound effect.
Okay, it's a biological virus. And then for it to affect Data, you're like, what? And then they have to write this exposition of why Data is drunk. Well, I'm biological just like you. And I have this I'm like, yeah.
But Kevin, you and I will do smoke and mirrors. If you want to see something, and you know there are like, the writer's room, you know, they're like, we got to see this. We got to see Data get horny. That, for whatever reason. Yeah. That was,
and we have to stress the writer's room.
Like, every white male in that writer's room.
We got to see Data get
DC
horny.
DC was in there. Was she the only woman in there?
She wrote this episode. Then they rewrote it 3 times. And she said, take my credit off of this.
Yeah, she changed.
That checks out.
DC Fontana wrote this episode. And she wrote... Counter Farpoint, and both times they rewrote the episode and she had her credit taken off of it.
Has anyone ever seen her original script for this? That'd be bonkers.
I have not. I have seen her original script for Encounter at Farpoint, which is actually a very tight hour-long episode which doesn't have Q in it.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, the Q is all
kind of like a bookend, I guess.
Yeah. Oh god, no. All of her episodes for season 1 of TNG were rewritten and sucked. Farpoint, The Naked Now, Lonely Among Us, Too Short a Season, Heart of Glory.
Of course.
They were all rewritten.
So to what extent is this a result of what I call Berman's vision?
No, Berman was not involved in this. We can all blame this on Gene.
I think Gene got okay. out.
We can all blame this on the big boy, the great bird of the galaxy himself.
Yeah.
I thought I had heard or read that, yeah, Gene, there's just a lot of struggles with the beginning of Next Gen and Gene's role. And he was in, who was it? There's some other big power in the room or on the show that was against what was trying to push Gene off, because Gene, I don't know.
Yeah, it's a big mess. Leonard does, no, Leonard Mazelich is Gene's batshit crazy lawyer. You guys know about Gene's lawyer, right?
I don't know about Gene's lawyer.
Gene's lawyer, when you've got a second, just look up, what's his name? Leonard Mazelich, who was Gene's lawyer. And it's one of the reasons that the Blood and Fire episode, AIDS Allegory episode was never made.
I can't remember how. What this person was like.
Gene's lawyer was a really strange man. He's arguably the reason Gene Roddenberry and Leonard Nimoy had a falling out in the 70s.
Oh no.
Wow.
Because basically he tried to screw Nimoy over for a bunch of credits and writing, and like basically said it was Gene's fault when it was mainly Mazelich trying to prove he was in charge. It's confusing. There's a lot of very interesting stuff written about that sort of decade between TOS and TNP, which basically consists of everybody trying to make as much money from it as quickly as they can.
It did seem like there was some sort of IP frenzy at some point.
It's not just an IP frenzy. It is Gene Roddenberry selling off everything he stole from the set when the show ended, and William Shatner running around South LA trying to sell off toupees. Which, allegedly. Wow. Please don't sue me, Will.
Can I bring up, so like the halfway point, they sort of figure out the connection with, you know, Naked Time and the Enterprise and stuff. And like, oh, we have an antidote, but this antidote doesn't work now. And I also, like, we were talking about feeling bad for Tasha Yar, but Beverly Crusher, like, she's like the chief medical officer and she's just failing left and right on this, like not in good ways.
Yeah.
And her son's committing mutiny.
Yeah.
Okay. While her son looks, yeah, nutso. But
I felt bad. For every right to say, hunt Wesley down and kill him. Like, maybe that's why he was continuing making those strange sounds.
The whole Wesley plot in this episode is weird, because it's like, I want to be a bridge officer so hard I made a fake Captain Picard's voice and he can give me orders. And like,
oh, was that something he had like pre-prepared?
Yeah. My main thought, this is disturbing, but also realistically something a teenager would do, because teenagers are not to be trusted. I know this because I was one.
Can't believe I'm finally accepting Wesley slander.
It's just weird. It's like, this might be the most, like, this is a sort of weird thing a teenager with an obsession might do. It's still pretty bad.
I thought I love Will Wheaton, and I fell in love with him when Stand By Me, and I think he's fantastic in Next Gen, but the writing for him though, like in this episode, you know, like Dan, like they could have written him like he should have been really intelligent, but they write, instead of truly sounding smart, he just
looks like a rascally 8-year-old.
He would just say like, I know everything that they're doing on the bridge. I know all that. He doesn't come across as highly intelligent. You know what I mean? It's like they're writing him to be, but the performance is not his fault, but the dialogue and what's given to him doesn't make him really seem as intelligent as he's supposed to be as a character.
Will Wheaton is exceptional when he's given good writing, and he was not until season 2.
Yeah.
And then he does become sort of golden child. Or some sort of, prophetic thing with him, right?
Yeah, yeah. From like where no one has gone before, which is actually a really, really good episode. The Traveler's like, oh, he's a special boy, and he's like Mozart. He's going to be a child prodigy and save you and all this and that. And
was that his last, Is that his last episode you're talking about?
No, it's in the first episode in Where No One Has Gone Before. The Traveler goes, the boy is special to Picard.
Yeah.
Oh, and like, there's a sort of idea that Picard knows that Wesley is destined for greatness and he shepherds him along and this and that. But they drop it as the show goes on because it just doesn't. It's very
exhausting. If you keep saying someone special, you start sort of not believing it.
Yeah, and it's sort of like it's the show not tell thing, which is they keep telling us Wesley's special and not showing it. So they switch it around.
They built it up to a place where they just had to like freeze frame and have Wesley walk off stage into the oblivion of coolness.
Oh my god, I forgot they did. I forgot that Wesley.
Yeah, they're like, we got to wrap
in the middle of a deportation of an ethnic minority, just freeze frame and walks off screen.
Yeah,
it just didn't know,
like.
Yeah. So it's a crazy exit.
Journey's End is just a bad episode.
Yeah.
It's not even a quittable episode. It's just bad.
I feel like a lot of the complaints that we have with the episode kind of keeps coming back to a core issue of they're not like they've got potentially these fantastic characters who become fantastic characters in later seasons and stuff, but right now they're not being utilized. Like the doctor is not being utilized in being a great doctor. Wesley is said to be a prodigy and super smart, but he's just doing dumbass things all the time. And I'm not really, you know, they're saying that he's brilliant, but I'm not seeing him being brilliant, you know?
But also I would say that this isn't wholly a bad episode. It's just in the wrong place. Like, it feels like when you're on your sixth season and you're getting tired, you're like, let's do this one. But you know, having
not even that far out. I mean, just even later in season one, when people know the characters, that's when the comedy comes out because people know this person, and all of a sudden you're playing with the character because they're getting induced by this virus and they're acting strange. It's not funny right now because I don't know the character and they're acting strange.
But I mean, how much do you think the writers knew the characters at this stage? Like, usually in a writer's
room, I bet they didn't know the characters. Yeah, but they barely knew.
I think that might be the reason Naked Time works and Naked Now doesn't, which is that by Naked Time, they've really realistically been workshopping Kirk and Spock especially, and the main cast for about 2 or 3 years. You know, Spock as a character realistically exists in one form or another when they're writing Naked Time since they wrote The Cage, so since 64. Yeah. Whereas they wrote this really early on.
Yeah.
It's just they don't actually know who
they could have had unknown restraints that we don't know about, like, or constraints in the sense of you know, like they had to please a certain boss or get the script out by a certain time, and you know. I always think like things get mixed up.
Just like Naked Time, you know, Naked Time, you get that great moment of Spock trying to fight off the virus. And it's like, it's a powerful, really amazing acting performance that Nimoy's giving right now, where he's trying to do, what was it, math or something in his head, and he can't concentrate. And you see, it's like this inner demon that he's just trying to fight off. It was like, there's so many great moments in that episode, like taking this concept. But can I say, I have to do a shout out to, in Naked Time, Joey was the, I think he was the red shirt who was first affected, I think. And
the guy who locked himself in the captain's.
Joey, he's the guy who threatened to stab himself with with the kitchen knife. It wasn't a sharp blade. It was like a butter knife that he was like threatening to like, like there's close-ups of the knife, and he's like, I've got this butter knife, I'm gonna stab myself. And everyone's like, whoa, 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 whoa. But I was just like laughing when I watched that, because this who tries to stab themselves with a rounded ended knife?
Yeah.
Maybe it was too violent if it was sharp.
Yeah, I'm looking, here we go. Yeah, Joe Tormelin. Yeah, it's Joey. Yeah, it's that bit in early TOS where they're trying to go for a proper sort of grand cast show, and they just sort of decide that actually it's a bit too much effort, which fair. you know. But it's really interesting to me that they're trying to do the same thing. They just can't make it land.
What we've learned is, especially just your first 10 episodes, even, you know, for us, it was 20. Like, we tried to make sure, like, what are the greatest hits? What are the, back then, maybe it wasn't greatest hits, but they needed to, they're reestablishing Star Trek for a new audience, for the next generation. And like, making sure you're hitting these tentpole concepts. And the one thing I did like about Naked Now is they dealt with the mystery episode. It was this mysterious virus, and it was, you're not really sure what it was and what it was doing and stuff. But, you know, for us, like, our episode 2 off of our pilot was called Starstruck. And for us, it was like, it's baby steps, you know? And for us, it's like, these guys just found a starship. How do they fly it? How do you turn it left and right? Like, that, even that, they end up flying it into a dying star clap. So, yeah, anyways, I think it's too big of a swing, too early.
It's that thing. I think they just, it's interesting because you look at the rest of season 1 of TNG, I say in that first bunch, the big swing is Where No One Has Gone Before, and that's the one that really hits. Mm-hmm. Like the first 4 episodes, Farpoint, Naked Now, Code of Honor, The Last Outpost with the Ferengi, mm-hmm. then We Know What Has Gone Before, and then you sort of hit the mid-range of, you know, Lonely Among Us, Justice, The Battle, Hide and Q, Haven, Big Goodbye. You sort of hit this
run. Justice, the low range?
I think Justice is mid-range. It is bonkers, but it's not bad.
Justice is on my high art list. Amazing.
I'm really impressed, like, for Dan and I, it's utterly frightening when you start a series and you just want every episode to just be on fire, right? You just, like, because if you're starting a series, like, in today's times, you don't have an episode to waste. You can't mess up, right? Or else your show's over, right? And what do you think it is? Like, you know, Next Gen turned out to be an amazing cast of characters, amazing actors, amazing series in the long run, but it stumbled so much in that first season, and it survived it. I'm curious, how is it just the times back then? They just never canceled shows.
I honestly think that you guys just have it a lot worse than they did, in the sense that you can't make a mistake. You have to run the tightrope the first time and get it right. And even then, you look at how people like Warner Bros. And Netflix operate these days, you might even still be cancelled then. Yeah. But I think there was so much less invested in television, in the sense of like social capital and economic capital, that you could fuck up and people would go, let's have another go at it.
Yeah.
You know, as they pulled this up, I watched all of MASH this year, and like the first season of MASH, first 2 seasons of MASH are deeply passable but rather funny comedy. And then the show just takes off and flies. But they just went, they clicked and they said, we'll try it. And it's just, you couldn't do something like that, and you couldn't do the first season, because I think there's just so much on like getting it right the first time that's probably a bit unhealthy in some ways.
Here's context, at least it's not just outrageously offensive. It's almost what I do for any season 1 TNG episode. I mean, the next one's Code of Honor, which is just really...
Oh, my God.
...bringing it home for the early TNG season.
And even Code of Honor is a sign of how much leeway they have. You can write something that abysmally terrible, and they go, yeah, let's see what we do next week.
Yeah, they've taken Dasha Yar, they've taken Lieutenant Yar, like, oh, God, like, what's going to happen now? You know, there is one good thing that came out of Naked Now, and when I rewatched it, I never knew this word, snootful. Did you guys take that note, snootful? Did you look up what snootful means?
Snootful is a word. It is a word I'm aware of. But it's a sort of word that belongs in a Sherlock Holmes book.
Which I love it.
Even more. As much as one can take of something. Okay.
Well, basically drunk. You've hit the drunk point.
Oh. Who said it? I don't remember.
Picard says it.
Says, oh, of course, it was Picard.
The initiation appears they invented.
Does he say like yo being snootful?
I don't know. Yeah, I'll probably butcher it, trying to using it in a sentence, but yeah.
Yeah, it's. I mean, do you guys think you obviously operate under much different production constraints, but you just wouldn't, if somebody pitched you an episode that felt like this, you just might not, you wouldn't even risk it, would you?
No.
No.
I mean, No.
No, what we do is so overly thought out and crafted. Like, even when we first pitched the show, we knew what our finale was going to be. Like, what you're about to see in episode 19 and 20 was what we pitched in the room when we first were trying to sell people on the Star Trek show. And I think what's interesting when you see, you know, Naked now, it seems like, first of all, it's a different animal. It's a procedural, you know, you don't need to know what episode 5 and episode 10 and then 15 and 20 is. So that's why it feels like they'll write an episode and they'll go, oh, a little bit too naked, a little bit too sexy. Let's bring it back and let's go back to scary. Whoa, let's maybe, you know, and they're trying to feel it. They're trying to figure out it while they're writing each episode
but also it's the importance of having a diverse writing room. It's so important to find people to, if you have blinder spots on, because you will have blinder spots, things that you'll try to do and people like, ugh, I wouldn't do that. And then and then you talk about it, and then I don't know, I think that's a big deal where you look at when you think of Star Trek writer rooms in the olden times, you know, you just picture the same, I don't know, same dudes.
And I think it's also that a lot of the episodes were written and then sort of posted or handed in. People didn't really work on it in a long-term collaborative space.
You're right.
City on the Edge of Forever, which is like one of the best in Star Trek. Harlan Ellison wrote that and then just sort of walked in, were like, here you go, and then went home.
Yeah.
And waited for him to get back to him.
That's true. I mean, ours is so collaborative. Like, you know, we break it out as a room, you know, with that writer of the episode. We're all doing it together. We're beating out.
Even before we break it out, we kind of talk about, well, what would we want to see in the season? And someone would be like, a holodeck episode or...
Yeah, we'll figure out our concepts and what, you know, what each episode roughly is, but we'll beat it out to beats. Like within every scene, we might even know, like, here are the 5 things that need to happen in that scene or whatever. And then we let the writer write the script, and, you know, they're off away for maybe 1 week and then they come back and then we're all working on it together, you know? So that's so different, you know? We'll probably spend 6 weeks together on an episode with 1 week, you know, with the writer by themselves versus what they do where the prior writer went off for 6 weeks and came back and that's the script.
I mean, from what I know, like, you're getting like 1 a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks of rewriting script. And usually this is just given to one other person. Hmm. But it makes sense because they're working like that so quickly they turn these scripts out. Whereas, you know, presumably you guys could bank your 10 scripts done and then you do that.
Oh, it's crazy though. There's times though when you're producing and writing them, like there was times where I felt like we were working on 40 episodes, like at the same time, like different stages.
It's so hard because animation, the schedule is so much longer, right? So there's a point where we're doing, I don't know, visual effects or sound and music on, you know, season 1 episodes, but we're in the writer's room writing season 2 episodes, or like the end of season 2, like 20 episodes later. And then in the middle of season 2, we're starting animatics and giving notes. So it's just like, yeah, you're literally looking at a spectrum of like 2 seasons and giving notes on them.
I think what's funny too, it's like my personal apprehension about being a Trek fan is knowing these little details. It's like a history class where I don't even know the titles of our own series. Like I just think of them as like, oh, this is the space elevator one. This is
holodeck episode.
Holodeck episode. Like, I don't know what the titles are.
The body swap. Oh yeah.
Should know.
How did Murph's metamorphosis sort of play out in the writer's room? Do we have any cut scenes of what could have happened to him?
Yeah, Kevin. Yeah, well, Murph was nearly not was a very late addition to the crew. It was almost like it was like the first week in the Nickelodeon office, and we're all like, this feels weird, just doing a Star Trek show in a Nickelodeon office. And we're like, I bet what if there's like a big old blobby dog? We're like, ha 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 ha, and then we're like, wait a minute, why not? Like, we go through some
and
dark
how stuff. how do we make Murph cool? And like, if you guys are ever in LA, we could give you a tour of our offices, and we have a bunch of concept art. Like, someday it's in the works, but we want to do an art of Star Trek Prodigy book where you can really see the iterations of a lot of the art and the character design. But man, Murph went through so much.
Oh my gosh. I was just looking at what his previous iteration, Kevin, and it was like Kevin and I were wrong. We were hell bent on going, we got to make Murph ugly, like a bulldog,
funny,
like slimy, like a puzzler.
Funny, ugly.
What a funny, tragedy.
Funny, cute, ugly. And then everyone's like, I don't know if this is really landing. And we're like, he's going to sound like a walrus. He's going to be this big old whatever. And then Heather Caden's like, here's an idea. What if we make him cute? And we were like, I don't know. Like, that's.
We were just scared of like the big eyed, like, caricature.
We were so trying to keep it away from that, like Disney, you know, overly. Yeah.
We want a lovable companion in Star Trek. It's a great.
Yeah, this final design, we're like, oh my god, this is it, because Murph looked adorable. Murph does have that an actual biological animal look, like not a cartoon character, but the black eyes and the, you know, kind of resembles a walrus or a seal or something, right? But
John, your Murph theory, which I don't know if you know has been realized because you've seen the finale.
Which
Murph? What's the Murph theory?
But your theory that Murph is changing to look more like his friends, which I think is the most adorable thing ever.
We do that. That was an idea that he was picking up on stuff with his friends. I think when you see. When he's running around with the phasers, with the two phasers, that's what Dal does. Like, he has his two phasers.
Yeah.
So, we like the idea that he's picking up DNA from each of the crew people.
Yeah, he's learning.
What point did you go, this blob has to be voiced by Parry the Platypus? What was the point where you went, that's the only option?
We were hesitant about that first. We wanted to just use walrus sounds, like, but there wasn't a big enough walrus library. Because we wanted
just like we'll power up fund us trip. To go and record walruses.
I mean, imagine it'd be so cool to have like a walrus talk.
Just leaning over the side of like a zoo with like a big microphone with like a walrus. It's like,
yeah.
Checking to see if any of the zookeepers
get him to sound scared. You know, get him to cry.
But that's what's always fun about animals is you never know what's going to come out of their mouths. You know, they're always like, and all of a sudden there's like a popping sound. You're like, what the hell is that? But we wanted, you know, that vibe. And
we didn't think an actor would be able to do that. But then
yes.
Yeah. The thing that surprised us.
He made like a flute. He had his hands and he was like, I'm like, oh my God.
Oh my God. Incredible.
And then what worried us most is the episode started to come out and people really liked Murph. And we're like, we thought people would like Murph, but like, wow, like people were really like, if anything happens to Murph, I'm
gonna
like,
I almost felt bad. I was like, I know I'm focusing on this one character. I do love the show as a whole, but I cannot stop and I will not stop.
Yeah. it's just such a wonderful collection of character. I mean, actually, I think that's always the thing, even the Naked Now to cycle back, can't even let down, is that Star Trek just creates such great selection of characters. It's like they're not very well written in that 45 minutes, but they're great characters. You kind of like, I can forgive this.
Yeah.
And I think you just sacked the combination you got, but just is great. I mean, you brought back the Medusians. Like, yes.
Yeah.
One of the most mental concepts on TOS, and they're back.
Yeah. Because again, we're animation. We can do that, you know? We're like looking at species, we're like, wow, this would probably be hard to do on any of the other shows. Let's do this.
Those are the things that we loved about Star Trek too, or things that would kind of like push your brain, you know, even the SETI eel, that it would make, it can make you go mad, or, you know, like a Medusa, one look at it can make you go mad. We're like, we love taking these sci-fi concepts and making them to be, you know, consumed for all audiences. You know, I wouldn't say just kids, but yeah, I think.
But we fall in love at an early stage. We fall in love with the concept or the arc of a character, right? So if you look at Zero, we knew Zero begins as a character who's used as a weapon to hurt others. And then Zero is going to become a medical officer, you know, like even though they don't have a physical body, Zero is going to care for others and heal. Like, what a beautiful.
Zero's original form was different too. Zero was originally like a bipedal robot, a little bit like a C-3PO. But Kurtzman said, no, this looks too much like everyday.
Looks sci-fi. Kurtzman had a robot. Kurtzman, this is one of the few times where Kurtzman's like gave us a note on something, and he was 100% right on. You look at, you know, a bipedal mech, and you instantly think robot. You know, even though you might see a light or whatever in a window inside the body, and he was like, no, like you got to do something different for Zero, and I'm so happy that we did. You know, it's much more clear that it's a containment suit.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Very endearing.
I'm like, this is. Could you? The Naked Time is an endearing episode. Is The Naked Now endearing?
Not quite.
Or endearing?
Endearing. Do you love it? Is there a way to love
arousing?
The Naked Now?
Arousing? Is that what you're trying to say? Endearing.
Well, we have sometimes when I quit, I feel so bad that we've like eviscerated an episode. I'm like, let me find one thing I love about it. I'm struggling.
No, you know what? I've got it. The Ron Jones score. The best part of all of season one of TNG is Ron Jones.
What happened to the music? I love
Rick Berman said it cost too much, so they cut it.
Berman.
I mean, I'm not surprised because Ron Jones was churning out like.
Wait, when was the music?
At the end of season.
That?
Ron Jones's last score is Best of Both Worlds Part One.
Okay.
Why did they do this to us?
Because he was shockingly expensive.
And they replaced it with synth?
They sort of have this weird, they sort of replaced it with fairly standard. What they stopped doing is writing specific scores for specific episodes.
They just reused stuff.
Across 1, 2, and 3, there were very specific scores. Like, you know, I think his most famous one might be he writes the Romulan theme for the Neutral Zone, which then turns up every time the Romulans reappear all the way through to like Voyager.
Yeah.
You know, sort of high pitch, sort of bouncing the right one. And he does.
I wonder if Nami used that in Prodigy.
I think she did. She has nods. She has like, they're nods because you have to pay money, you know, to each of these if you're going to reuse a theme or, you know. But I mean, I for us, like music is so important, you know, and right away, you know, Dan and I felt like we're not going to have the budget for like an orchestra. So we're just going to have like a four piece, a cello, a bassist, a violinist, you know, and a flutist or whatever, you know. I love like the music in Lost, you know, and what Michael Giacchino did there was very, very few instruments, but it was very emotional and it added this beautiful voice and texture to Lost.
Well, you did exceptional work on your opening theme as well.
Yes. Yeah, so we were at a
and Giacchino's like, yeah, let's do it. We're like, oh my gosh, this is awesome.
We were at a party with Giacchino and Dan and I were just geeking out because we love movie music and we love his work. And we were just like telling him about this new Prodigy show we're doing. And he was directing the short from one of the Star Trek shorts at the time. And he was just like, hey, if you guys want, I could do your opening theme. And I was just like, I was just dumbstruck. I was just like, what? You know, and then we were working with him and he's like, guys, I think we could try to find a budget orchestra for you. Because I was telling him how I wanted just like, I didn't want a synthesizer. I wanted a 4 or 5 piece. And he's like, I think I could maybe help get an orchestra for you. And now we do. And I just love what Nami does with the music.
It is fantastic. And I think so much People get, I get quite upset about the end of the, like, Ron Jones not being able to do, like, a Cardassian theme and, like, a DS9 theme. But so much of, like, what people remember from Star Trek episodes is built around musical themes. Like, everyone remembers what the Tribble episode sounds like. It has such a distinct sound.
Iconic fight music.
Yeah.
Love it.
Yes.
And we know what the Romulus, we know what, like, Kirk fighting Finnegan sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we know what, like, and even if, like, we know what, the Chris Pine Star Trek sounds like. It's got that Giacchino sort of sound, and Prodigy just has such a distinctive sound to it as well.
Yeah. I have to say, like, if there was any sort of tune that's constantly going into my head, it's Enterprising Young Men from Giacchino Star Trek. Yeah, it's just, I can't get it out of my, it's ingrained in me now. It's in my DNA.
My tragedy is I got into Star Trek by going to see Star Trek Into Darkness at a friend's birthday party.
What? How old are you? 19?
22.
Here we go.
Are you 18?
I'm 22.
Okay. I was like,
geez. Olivia's 24.
I frequently bully John for being born in 2000.
23 months older than me.
Yes. And at least I was born in the 90s.
Wow.
I had the respect to be born in a reasonable decade, John, and that's the difference between you and me.
So wait, John, you got into Star Trek from the Abrams films and then worked your way back.
Okay. Well, my parents were Trekkies. They just decided not to tell me. And every once in a while I find something out like, we had the Star Trek scene played at our wedding, or I remember seeing an open picture on the first time at the Prince Charles Cinema in London when it was first shown. Or
your mother slept with William Shatner once.
Oh no, she wouldn't have done that. No, my mom has taste. Sorry, Bill. I don't know if you listen, but I presume you do.
No.
The music's great, and I think Prodigy I work on playlists for writing. It's the Prodigy one went immediately onto my, like, I need to listen to this when I go to work playlist.
It's so important.
It's just funny. I was just going to say, it's so funny, like, how nervous we were about doing this show, and then the embarrassment of riches and the help that we've gotten from people like Nami, from people like Alex Kurtzman, from Ben Ivan, like the board artists. It's just amazing. And then it's like you're putting up a carnival, and then, you know, you're afraid it's going to look like dog shit, and then you find out that the show turns out and it's pretty amazing, and it really is a testament to the crew and how hard they work and. You know,
well, I was thinking the same thing about how, you know, it starts with this love of Trek, like we all grew up on it, and it's so important to us. And it's like, we don't want to, you know, we feel that legacy, we feel that pressure of this could be the show to help get that young new generation into Star Trek. And so we work our butts off with our room to write an amazing script. And what's so awesome is then it goes to, like, Ben Ebon, our supervising director, and he's totally inspired by the pages. And then he's delivering, and his team are delivering some, just the concept art that comes to us. And, you know, it's amazing, right? And then you start to see, you know, there's multiple steps, but the animation, then Nami will see the animation. She's like, oh my God, I now have to do music that's going to be equal level to these gorgeous visuals. Or our sound designer, you know, Otis, will be looking at this stuff and going, holy heck, this is going to be one hell of a complex sound design that I got to bring, because everything else is cinematic. You know?
Yeah.
I think the one to me that exemplifies that is when you do the episode of all the Enterprisians.
Yeah. Where
all of the sound work, all the musical nods sound, it's like, this is fucking cool.
It all came together.
So fucking cool.
Yeah,
like when it's like when they recreate the bridge on the Protostars bridge, I'm like, and everything sounds right. And I'm like, yeah.
Oh yeah.
It's like, yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, I love I you know, just props to our prop team who creates the assets and the props. And man, like, what's his name? Who's the guy who's on Twitter who's freezing every.
Yeah,
York is fantastic.
He is pulling the stuff out and he's zeroing in on the stuff. And I'm always like, oh God, what is he going to find now? Like, he's zeroing in.
No,
and
he finds something that our
prop. yeah, the L cars and all the prop designs and the details. He's like, yep, matches perfectly with this. Or like, you know, he'll catch some inconsistencies. But for the most part, props to our prop team who's like designing these things. And they've done their research, right? Because they love Trek so much.
I mean,
I just want to add, it's like what's super nervous is like the buck kind of has to stop at Kevin and I. So when we're watching these episodes, like, okay, is everything where it's like we have to have so much trust in our other filters to make sure that we, you know, it looks good.
Because you can't do everything. Oversee everything.
It's this long thread of beautiful, like incredibly nerdy but beautiful tradition that goes back to George Takei turning to a director and going, no, I can't press that button because that's not what that button does. This is the button that fires the phasers. And then they're sort of looking at him and going, what the fuck are you talking about? That makes no sense. What gives us the button? Like, no, this is the right button.
I have to imagine going from like any post 2006 Trek show to the previous years is like walking into the wilderness. Because even I started with TOS and it could only get. You know, TOS has its faults. I love it. It's still one of my favorites, but it can really only get better in terms of, you know,
potential
for the characters.
Well, that's what's so interesting because, I really started from the beginning and moved my way through. And you know, unlike you, John, who started late with the later work. And then, like, what do you like? So going back and then you're seeing the super old TOS stuff with the campiness to it and the terrible set designs and this and that.
Amazing set design.
They're amazing, but you know what I'm saying. Like, even in, I think it was Naked Time, there's like a laboratory and there's just a bunch of like two spray bottles on the counter. Like that's their props. They had two spray bottles.
I mean, my favorite is
medical lab.
Is it Errand of Mercy? There's a shot on the bridge at the beginning where you can see they've not cropped it properly and Spock's like standing off the edge of the set. Like, Leonard Nimoy's foot is off the edge of the set. It doesn't seem that too far. It's like, everyone sort of looked at that in the cutting room and went, oh, fuck it. Let's just fucking get it.
I love the theater kid energy. They were trying their best.
They were. But John, like, what series is your favorite? Like, what stands out growing up?
It's an original, you know? To me, well.
The original.
I think it was original series, I think, because it just sounded so good. There was just so much of it felt so different to other TV that even as I was growing up, that's different. I think I know I did TNG first and I loved that. And then I did DS9 and then Netflix took it all off British Netflix for a bit. And my dad had some TOS DVDs and that was about a year and a half that I just watched that over and over and over again. Like I can quote Balance of Terror completely, line for line.
Wow.
Like you got to imagine how excited I was when Strange New Worlds did Balance of Terror again.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, God, oh, yeah. But I think I sort of did TOS, and then I finally watched all of DS9 just for the pandemic. But it is TOS all the way for me. I mean, I've written, I don't need to discuss what I've written, but I've written too many things TOS-related and spent too much money on making it look pretty and stuff. So, okay.
One thing, like, Dan and I always talk or teach or to young writers, you know, and it's not just about making a great character. Like sometimes you're like, oh, you make a great character arc. I'm like, no, it's about a great relationship. It's about two characters or a crew of characters. Because any, you know, if it was just the Kirk show, it would have been fine. If it was just the Spock show, it would have been fine. But you put Kirk and Spock together and suddenly there's this great chemistry and a great battle of wills and minds, right? And I think that's what really made that show great, or makes a great story really good. That's one of the things I think Strange New Worlds has done really, really well, is they've got a fantastic crew not just because they're interesting characters, but how they relate to one another, you know?
Yeah, that's what set Star Trek as it was, apart from Gene's original pitch, was that Gene's original pitch was Hornblower. And Hornblower is a bunch of story about a man alone. And this is not really, it's great books. It doesn't translate well to television, I think. And I think the difference they made, what they figured out between The Cage and Where No Man Has Gone Before made the show what it is. It made it possible to, as it is, a show about relationships.
Yeah, and that's what, for Prodigy, it was really important for us. It's not, this isn't Dal's show, you know, and I love how people It's the Murph show. It's all about Murph. But they all gravitate. People gravitate to different characters. And so I really love it when I hear people who love Murph. Some people love Gwyn. Some people love Dow. Some people love Zero. Rock and Jankum. Like I've heard it all. And I love that, you know.
I mean, really, it's Murph and Rock as a duo, which is one of the sort of best aspects of that.
Is that your favorite duo? Like your favorite relationship? Yeah.
Oh yeah, you used to ask me earlier how I felt about Murph's transition. The one thing that I would love to see is a plushy Murph original before the change.
I know, right?
He's growing up fast.
We're always trying to push people, but you know, it's always they need the show to be a hit. They need the show to be to warrant creating 80,000 of those things or whatever, right?
So I mean, what they haven't clocked is that if a kid sees a Murph toy and wants a Murph toy, they're then going to want to see the Murph show, and bam, mm-hmm. they've killed two birds with one stone. They've forgotten that children.
Yeah.
At least that's I don't work in marketing. I'm too interesting.
We love, like, Murph is like the living metaphor of our crew. You know, Murph starts off as like almost like a single cell organism almost, right? And then it starts to actually evolve, and you know, and where our hope is that if the show ever continues to go for more seasons, that you would continue to see Murph, you know, go through his metamorphosis and continue to grow up and become an adolescent. So
teen rage Murph.
That would be funny.
Oh god, no. I mean, actually, yes, now I think about it, yes. We should Olivia, do we want to do, are we going to subject the Hagman brothers to triplets for the next
I think
hour?
We'd have to at least do our triplets.
Explain to these poor, far more talented and better paid than us people what a triplet is.
I'm so sorry for what I'm about to do. Triplets are based on the Enterprise episode Unexpected, in which Trip Tucker gains new nipples after an encounter with an alien.
You get them
so
pregnant.
Our Tripnip scale to say the word. Our Tripnip scale is a scale of cursedness of a Star Trek episode. If you've got 10 Tripnips, you're panicking. You're in Dr. Blox's office having a breakdown. It's a terrible episode. But if you only have 1 to 5 Tripnips, maybe it's fine for you. So that is our Tripnip scale.
You're saying Tripnips.
Tripnips.
It's
the lower the nips, the better. You're not freaking out. The more nips, you're really freaking
trip
out.
Nips. Trip nips.
Yeah, like yep. He becomes pregnant in that episode, to be clear, which is why he, for some reason,
you can't have a worse first season than Enterprise, where they went for the M-preg 4 episodes in.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Maybe we in context we should be less harsh.
We've done that. We did that in a Trollhunters movie, but we totally went in knowing this is going to be so ridiculous, and we had utter fun with it. And
I mean, it was Trollhunters, which is great. You know, it wasn't fucking Scott Bakula. You know.
No.
yeah.
No.
All right. So you're going to ask us questions, and we have to give it how many?
On your innate feelings about the episode, how cursed do you think it is, and how many tripnips would you give it?
Oh my gosh, we'll have 10? To see those episodes. We'll have to either lie or give it an unknown.
What?
Like, how cursed was the Naked Now in your view?
Oh, just Naked Now.
Just Naked Now. Just don't worry, we're not going to ask you.
I would give it probably 8 tripnips, because especially for it being the first standalone episode after that pilot,
I would agree with 8 for Picard's lean alone. That was upsetting to see.
Yeah
I'd say 8. I kind of want to say 7, but I think Kevin hit the trip.
I'm giving it 8, but I'm reducing it to 6 just for being a member of the Ron Jones defense squad.
Okay. Fair enough.
It's a -2 tripnets just for how the Ron Jones score is good. It's not actually important in the episode. Ron Jones, everyone needs to remember that Ron Jones is really good at what he does.
Yeah.
So that gives us an average of 7.5 nipples, which is high. It's not a night in sick bay high, but it's high. It's the highest we've had this.
Do you have another episode that is more nips?
A night in sick bay. Angel One.
Oh yeah, and we really did see a lot of.
It was the one where the women
Angel
were in
One?
The one where the women where Riker were in has chest, that and Riker sash. Has the shirt that's open.
Open chest for Riker.
Oh, yeah. It's, oh, my God.
And then everybody on the ship gets, like, the flu from Wesley throwing a snowball.
Just it's, classic.
It's bad.
I don't... Yeah.
I mean, if you memory hold it, go and watch it and then sort of think about what you've done and sit on the stairs for a minute.
I don't
know if I've seen that one. Angel One?
Angel One. Season
I feel like
one of TNG. I want to say episode like 13 or 14.
I feel like the sash would be ingrained in your memory if you had seen it. It's remarkable. Turquoise, I'll have blue to, pants.
Unlike us, Olivia, normal people don't have encyclopedic knowledge of bad episodes of Star Trek. They just do interesting
it's
things.
Trauma.
With
this
lives.
Podcast is a labor.
Yeah, labor love. Okay. I was about to say, while we come to play Angel One, do you guys have anything to plug to our listeners? But
I do have something to plug.
I think you might now I think about it.
Our Star Trek Prodigy first half of season one comes out in January, so on DVD, Blu-ray DVD.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, yeah.
So, fantastic. And if you aren't already watching Star Trek Prodigy, do.
Yeah.
That's an order. Yeah,
please,
a suggestion.
Please do. We want to see. We want a season three.
Yeah.
We want a season three. We don't want to be one of the most short-lived Star Trek series ever.
You've already made more episodes than the animated series made, so you're fine.
Oh, poor animated series.
Don't defend
they
them.
Made, what
I'll
did
defend
they
the
they
animated
made,
series.
They made 18 episodes.
They made 30? 18?
They did one season of 12 and then one season of 6.
Sad.
Okay.
I mean, there's like one good episode of the animated series. It's the rest of it. It's great
yeah,
music.
It was...
But
visually spectacular.
It.
I don't know what you're talking about, John. I want to see Giant Spock.
Oh, no, wait. I checked. No, they did 22 episodes. I missed some. Okay. Well, you guys will make these.
Yeah. No, 22. So, well, I guess we're going to have 40 coming out. So.
Yeah, but so there you go. Already. You've beaten the animated series. Congratulations.
Okay, good. Good. And then the next shortest was Enterprise.
Oh. Yeah, 4 seasons.
That one's deeply upsetting, actually.
Yeah. It's just...
Yeah. Blame the theme.
Have you done the last episode of Enterprise on this?
Yes, we did. Yes. We did it with Noah Azabak Kaz.
That's his last name.
I just could see it in my head, and then I was missing the middle bit. Anyway, Noah Azabak Kaz, we did it with him as our 50th episode. Olivia, who had not seen most of Enterprise before that.
Yeah, he bullied me into watching. He made me experience that terrible finale, which, to be fair, it's self-contained. It's nonsense. It's fine. I just pretend it doesn't happen. It didn't happen to me. Wow. That brings us to the end.
That brings us to the naked now.
And on that note, thank you so much, you guys, for coming on. This has been an absolute pleasure. This took us months to finally get scheduled, everyone. So
oh, my gosh.
It was both embarrassing and a little concerning.
We tried to run away. We tried to hide. Yeah. We tried to do everything we could to avoid you two. And
tried to get
you
COVID.
Broke our will.
We broke our will. Involved our lawyers. There was a manhunt.
We involved lawyers.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm under duress right now.
SAS went off.
You can't tell it, but there's someone on the other side of this computer. I'm under duress. I have to do this.
It is a little better. I'm all kind of like clammy during this episode because I feel like maybe.
Yeah, the episode really was like space COVID. It was like a space COVID episode.
Yeah, but COVID wasn't this interesting.
Yeah.
Like, they weren't watching Tiger King, were they?
How cool would COVID be?
If we were all pissed. Actually then again, during
if we all
COVID,
got horny from if we all got horny from COVID.
during COVID,
Donald Trump would be like, boys and girls, this is going to be awesome.
This is going to be the best.
Masks off.
I mean, during COVID, we were brewing beer in my flat, so we were basically pissed from about 1 p.m. every day. So we roll out of bed at midday, make lunch, have a pint of beer you brewed yourself, and then just get on with your day.
Fauci would come out in a smoker's robe. Be like, ladies and gentlemen.
Cigar in his mouth. And on that interesting note, I've been John.
I've been Olivia.
I've been better.
And I've been better's older brother, Kevin.
And until next time, folks, write better episodes of the first season of your Star Trek show.
Just
do it. These guys did. They did it all the time.
You got to hit the ground running.
Merry Christmas. Actually, wait, this is coming out in January. Shit.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Bye, everyone.